Hello, podcasters. If you're looking for a show about cartography, you've come to the wrong place. This week, Polly's Pay, Twitter, and Obama's first 97 days. Visit Student Radio on the internet at studentradio.wordpress.com. Left, right, and centre, introducing the Internet Pollution Reduction Scheme.
Student Radio may contain coarse language and adult content. Listener discretion is advised.
And we're going to leave it up to you as to who is the clowns and who are the jokers.
Well, I actually think there are clowns to the left of me and jokers to the right, and it's the rest of the team. I'm Chris, by the way.
And I'm Casey.
I'm Timothy.
I'm Mateo.
And you're listening to Left, Right and Centre, as always, every week. Second week in a row, the whole team has been united, and it feels great.
And we'd just like to apologise for what you heard previous to our show beginning. That will be the end of Break It Down with Lewin and Bryce.
That, in fact, the end of Break It Down with Lewin and Bryce in more than one way. Yeah. After that, never again
You don't get to play Katy Perry and come back for another week.
No. Definitely not.
I quite enjoyed it.
It was catchy, but doesn't mean I ever want to hear it.
Just the same, it was just a shame it wasn't. I Kissed a Girl.
Yeah, I like that song. What's this week in this show right now for the next hour?
Well, we're going to talk about Barack Obama. It's in fact, in Australia, it's just turned, I believe, the 100th day of Barack Obama's presidency.
Not quite yet.
I think Casey looked this up and it was 97 days.
It is 97 days, 21 hours, 40 minutes and 41 minutes now that Barack Obama's been president.
So, Casey, I think it's April 29th
in the United States.
Is Obama president, Casey?
It's not now.
He is president, yes.
That's good.
Well, doesn't that make the segment a bit of a misnomer? Shouldn't we really call it Obama's first 90?
No, but look, it's a review.
Almost 98 days.
I think we're just assuming, yeah. Barack Obama's almost 98th day in power would be a stupid name for a
session. We are also going to talk about remuneration for our members of federal parliament.
Remuneration, Tim.
Remuneration, I think you'll find.
Okay.
No, remuneration would be like something to do with numbers, I believe.
I made some rather embarrassing mistakes about that in the first show, and I had to look it up in the OED just to make sure.
In the OED?
Yeah.
Oxford English Dictionary.
No, I understand.
That's where you go.
Because if anything, you're rigorous.
We're also going to be talking about the Hutt River Province, aren't we, Casey?
Well, we'll hear a bit about that, a little bit later on. But first, this morning I was getting ready for my day at university.
And the radio stuff, getting ready, getting dressed, getting changed.
Watching Sunrise, as I normally do. Watching Sunrise with Koshy and Mel. And what should I hear but this?
Could the internet run out of space? I don't know much how this internet business works, but I thought it just went through the air. US scientists are warning the popularity of video sharing sites like YouTube is putting a major strain on cyberspace, and they say by 2012 could get full and become an unreliable toy.
So what does all that mean? And what exactly will this impact? How will it impact your internet use? And what's been done to stop it from happening? Let's ask our gadget guy, Pete Blasino. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I suppose this is something you kind of can't put into concrete, but can the internet run out of space?
Oh, definitely. I'm surprised it hasn't happened earlier. It's been remarkable. The internet's about 5,000 days old, about 13 years old, and it hasn't broken down once in that time. So it's probably the most perfect machine we've built as humans. The thing is that when we built it, it was never meant to cope with what's happening now, and it was never meant to grow as rapidly as it has. Okay. And with video down there, going down the internet and so much entertainment, social networking, it's just at capacity, virtually at capacity now.
All right. Because it's called cyberspace, so we think it just appears out of the air. But is it right to say it comes through these big pipes?
Yeah.
Either through satellite or the ground, and just the pipes aren't big enough anymore. Does that explain it?
No, it doesn't.
Koshy and Mel there speaking to Pete Blasino about the internet. Apparently it's full, we should make the most of what lasts.
Is this for real? Are you saying the internet is going to be full?
Well, that's what I heard on Sunrise.
Well, that's what gadget guru Pete Blasino said on Sunrise with Koshy and Mel.
I'm extremely concerned about this. I rely on the internet for a lot of things, and I don't know what I'm going to do if it's not going to be there anymore.
From where will you get your suits, Christopher?
Indeed. I buy suits on eBay all the time. No, jackets. Generally, I haven't actually bought a full suit yet, but because it's going to be full, so nothing new will be added.
Yeah, nothing new can be added, so you can only buy things that are already on eBay.
But what if there's all the good things are bought?
Well, too bad.
Well, for one, I'm glad to see the end of the internet. I think it's been a negative influence,
nothing but a pain.
Especially with these My Books and the Twitter thing.
FaceSpace.
What?
FaceSpace.
No, you're getting them mixed up. There's Facebook and there's MyBook.
And there's that. Okay. And Tim, you were talking about Last FM before, where you scrabble things. Is that right?
Scrumble things.
No, Wumble.
Rumble. No.
Are you thinking of the little things in Wimbledon?
Look, guys. Perhaps. Actually, look, you're starting to get a bit flippant, but I actually think we need to address the fact that this is a serious issue. Well,
yeah, forget swine flu. This is it.
Do we start another internet?
Well, can we start another internet? That's the question. I mean, the problem is if it's getting full. I think
Rebel Net.
What? Ghost.
Maybe
net
one in the sky. Skynet.
Skynet. Yeah.
I don't know why, but something's making me feel uneasy about this Skynet idea.
I don't know. I mean, I think clearly there's a problem here. I mean, Casey, was this the whole thing? Like, was there any more to the report?
I had to leave to get the bus to come into. Assume it was the end. Had every 2 minutes on that show.
This is really worrying.
I suppose this is. We might need to do our bit, Casey, because obviously, as you're all well aware, we podcast left, right, and centre. Yeah. Do you reckon maybe it would be a good idea to reduce, you know, like our show by 25% over a set period of time?
Those days might have to end. Or maybe we can still upload the podcast but recommend that people don't download it.
I think maybe what we do is we have some kind of, the government needs to set up some kind of reduction scheme, like getting permits, internet permits,
and
which you can trade.
And over a set period of time, like, say, you know, like 5% by 2050 as an example.
A cyberspace permit reduction.
Yeah, so you trade, you can, if you don't use all of your allocation, you can trade them with other people for a profit. There's incentive there to reduce your internet
price for it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good idea. That might be the only manageable way. And also, we could have incentives for deleting stuff that's already on the internet. So if you've got something that you don't need anymore, traditionally, people will just leave it there. That's what happens. Like, websites that don't get used, they haven't been updated in years, people would be encouraged by this system, I think, to delete things. And then there'd be more space.
Internet content pollution reduction.
I think we need to draft this policy framework.
It needs to be done quickly. I'm demanding government action in the next week, because otherwise we're going to be in trouble.
By what, 25%?
Well, in the meantime, I'd suggest that while you still can, get on our Facebook group, Left, Right and Centre, and leave us comments and send an email.
And complain. We can leave a petition to the government. You know,
we need to build some groundswell here to make the movement alive.
It's all the same, or at least it is according to Wilderness, from the album The Same Name. If you like music, you'll like Wilderness.
That's a very strong statement there.
I think Wilderness is all the same. Like, I mean, it's much like any other, you know, you go to some wilderness, it's wild, and then you go to some more and it's also wild.
Tim.
We're going to talk about remuneration. We're all going to be stumbling over that word.
I have been chastened, can I just say. It is, in fact, remuneration.
Yes, there's an M, not an N. Anyway.
Try and say that word again.
What's happened this week is that the Remuneration Tribunal, who are an independent organisation who make recommendations as to the payment of certain public officials like judges and MPs, have said that have given, you know, blessing to an increase of just under $5,000 in the electorate allowance, which is what effectively is a sum ranging from about $30,000 up to $46,000 now. That's given to MPs in order to fund events and things in their electorate.
So that's in order so that they can use that money to use money for events for people in their electorate. Like public events and so on. And I think
ostensibly,
the amount they get depends on the size of the electorate.
Yeah. So if you've got a very very large electorate,
that's area, not population.
Then you get slightly more money. But this has raised an interesting issue, and obviously MP pay is something that becomes a bit of a political thing.
Well, especially now.
Whenever it happens, so, you know, what do we think of that? I mean,
well, I think one of the issues that's been raised that's most interesting is that if they don't spend the full allowance, as in the full, because this is theoretically meant to be for use in the electorate, and if it doesn't get used, or some of it doesn't get used, that just gets added onto their taxable income.
Yeah. So a standard MP is earning at the moment about $127,000 a year, and they get this electorate allowance, among other things, and which is used, which effectively they get given, and they get it given tax free. The amount of it that they spend on, you know, electorate purposes is tax free. Whatever money that they haven't spent out of that fund by the end of the year is just simply tacked onto their taxable income by the ATO, the Australian Taxation Office.
Mm. So you wonder perhaps if the incentive is there for them to spend it
on the people.
Yeah, but I mean, there's been a word spoken against this. For example, Nick Xenophon, who always likes a bit of a headline, he said that this is a backdoor pay increase for members of parliament. Of course, he's I believe he's going to spend his or he already has on charity. He's going to donate to a charity. But of course, he can't really come out looking worse from this, because of course he gets the like, it's seen that he's donating it to charity, and yet him speaking out against it isn't going to prevent this legislation from passing.
Yeah.
But that's all that he can do, is to speak against it. He doesn't really get a say on whether he gets it or not.
Yeah.
So what else is he going to do? Either he shuts up about it and takes it,
but certainly can make some political capital from it.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think the point that Matteo makes is that what's happened in this situation is the two major parties have come out in support of it, and the Greens, primarily through Bob Brown and Nick Xenophon, have come out in opposition to it. And I think it's one of these situations where the third party it's a win-win situation for them, because if the two main parties are in favour of this thing, they're going to get the money anyway, and they still get to make some, you know, political capital out of whinging about it.
I'd say that actually I think there's an ulterior motive here for Bob Brown and Nick Xenophon, and that is they're both senators, right? And senators earn the lowest rate of this money. And so they, you know, basically they're taking it out on all the MPs in larger electorates, because they're senators, of course, they don't have an electorate. And basically, it's just because they're not getting as much money. They're bitter.
They can only pocket an extra $32,000.
Exactly. As opposed to 46. Yeah. That's a difference of 14 grand, and they're not happy. I'd also make the point, look, some people argue that there has been arguments put that the system would work better if the money wasn't spent, it went back to the government at the end of the year. But the problem with that is that often actually encourages MPs to, or it would probably encourage MPs to spend the money on ridiculous, unnecessary things just to spend the money. And that happens in public service a lot.
Yeah. I mean, but even then, I mean, one of the things I have about the issue specifically about this this electoral allowance is people talk about, you know, there's a quote here from the superannuation and corporate law minister, Nick Sherry, who is a senator, who said that it doesn't go to our pockets. I pay for local raffles, donations for charities, to sporting organisations. That's what I use the money for. And, you know, I just think, you know, obviously those are great things, but this is essentially political, you know, it's money that governments can use for funding things that are good for them politically.
But not just governments, because the opposition gets it as sitting members, members,
But of course, keep in mind that the tribunal, the remuneration tribunal, which actually recommended this, is supposedly impartial.
Yeah.
So you could say that any political gain made from it is incidental.
But it's not, because the thing is, the people who are voting for it are sitting members, and it benefits sitting members regardless of their political affiliation. Mm. So it will invariably help people who are already elected to Parliament stay in Parliament. Yeah.
But I think the point Matteo is making is that this is a recommendation that has been made by the tribunal who were set up in 1973 to figure this stuff out sort of as an independent body. But the problem, of course, with that is that constitutionally the Remuneration Tribunal doesn't have any power. The parliament has the power to choose pay for its own members, and the government can choose extra pay for ministers.
I just don't understand why this money, if it's not spent, goes into their pocket. I don't understand why logically that would make any sense.
Well, because they're the representatives of their electorate.
So they should pocket money they haven't spent on their electorate.
It's what happens when people decide their own pay. And the Constitution gives parliamentarians the right to set parliamentarians' pay, and the government to set the pay of ministers. And that's what happens if you have organisations setting their own pay. And they have the tribunal there as sort of a token organisation. But the fact of the matter is that they agree with the tribunal when it agrees with them.
I guess the broader question here, and one that we haven't quite touched on as directly as we might have, is do we think MPs in general are paid too much? I mean, both in terms of the current financial crisis, and also in terms of, you know, comparatively compared to the corporate sector, for instance.
Mm. Well, I mean,
well, comparatively compared to the corporate sector, they're not paid very much at all.
Exactly.
Mm. So I don't really see a problem with it. You're paying them a fairly good wage for a fairly difficult job, but not too much to encourage just people there for the money.
Well, perhaps it does have to be put into the context of the current sort of financial climate. And also, there's a quote from Bob Brown. I mean, I have a lot of time for Bob Brown, but he said here, you cannot justify my members of parliament getting extra $90 a week, even in this form, under these circumstances. And he's talking about, for example, he said, you know, why isn't this being spent on the pension instead? But of course, that's hardly a like-for-like thing, if I could just finish it off, because, of course, there's a lot more people eligible for pensions than there are for the electoral allowance.
The money that would be saved by not having this pay rise is a drop in the ocean.
It's a small drop
in the ocean. It's a very, very small amount of money. Anyway.
But should it not be spent on barbecues for the community or whatever, rather than
Raffles, yeah. Well, there's a lot to be said about this issue.
Well, raffles are good fun. I mean, so are barbecues. I don't see...
Barbecues are a lot of fun, yeah. Mm. Raffles, not so much. I never win.
What if you...
So this just in, everybody. Barbecues, a lot of fun.
Sometimes. Sometimes they're just kind of jerks there, so you don't really want to spend time with them.
What if... I think that's more a problem with barbecues, because you're actually spending more time with... Raffles are kind of quick things. What have we got now, guys?
We've got this now, guys. A micronation, also referred to as a model nation, is an entity unrecognised by world governments, but which resembles an independent nation. According to the default WordPress-themed website, micronations.net, which seeks to serve the micronational community, a micronation is an ideal environment for those who are interested in politics and communities to experiment with and experience different types of government, and to meet a diverse range of interesting people. It's a whole world unto itself. Micronations are started by all sorts of people, for all sorts of reasons. For example, the oldest micronation in Australia, the Principality of Hutt River, previously known as the Hutt River Province, was founded in 1970 in response to what Wrigley named Leonard George Casley thought of as a draconian wheat quota. The five families that owned farms in Hutt River, approximately 517 kilometres north of Perth, initially banded together in an effort to fight the Western Australian government quota. When the government threatened to compulsorily acquire, Casley resorted to Britain's Treason Act 1495, which he felt allowed secession. The families declared their independence from the Commonwealth of Australia, and Casley was elected administrator of the new sovereign state by his completely unbiased, I'm sure, family. In an attempt to take control of the situation, the government threatened Casley with prosecution. In response, Casley, being the wily little minx that he is, named himself His Royal Highness Prince Leonard I of Hutt, taking advantage of a Commonwealth law that a monarch could not be charged and that anyone who interfered with his duties could be charged with treason. Even though this law has changed, the Australian government has not taken any action against Hutt River since the declaration. In a tremendous show of buck-passing on the issue, the Western Australian government determined that they could not do anything about the situation without the intervention of the Commonwealth. In turn, the Governor-General of Australia stated that it was unconstitutional for the Commonwealth to intervene in the secession. In the 1980s, Hutt River Province declared itself to be a kingdom. However, in a bold move of indecision, shortly reverted to the status of principality. Casley is married to Her Serene Highness Princess Shirley and has seven adult children. Among them is His Royal Highness Crown Prince Ian, designated as his eventual successor as Sovereign Prince. The Principality of Hutt River also has its own currency, the Hutt River dollar. This is divided into 100 cents and is tied at a 1-to-1 ratio with the Australian dollar. Special coins are also sometimes minted for special occasions, such as the 60th wedding anniversary of the Prince and Princess in 2007. The Principality claims a worldwide citizenry of 13,000, even though the actual population is about 20, and exports include wildflowers, agricultural produce, and stamps and coins. Tourism is also a large part of the local economy. A Bill of Rights was drafted when the Principality seceded, which also provided for an administration board to govern until a permanent form of government could be created. This clause lost effect when Casley declared himself Prince, and the region effectively became a benevolent monarchy. There's also a legislation committee to draft new legislation, which in 1997 finished a proposal for a constitution. The Prince and Cabinet are yet to adopt the constitution, but it does act as a de facto constitution due to a clause in the Bill of Rights. While it has no standing army, a number of its residents have been given military commissions, including naval commissions, despite the fact that it's completely landlocked. A 2005 statement on the Australian Taxation Office website says that the Australian government does not legally or otherwise recognise the so-called Hutt River Province. We are concerned that the companies and other entities may be sold as part of a tax avoidance or evasion arrangement. People should avoid any arrangements involving Hutt River Province, international business companies and any other entities because they have no legal basis and could be illegal.
Looking back at it, we were quite negative about the possible ramifications of this internet thing. But actually, one of our listeners has quite correctly pointed out that it could have positive consequences too. Is that right, Casey?
Yeah, we've had a couple of comments. One of them is from Jordan, who sent us an email at leftrightandcentre@live.com.au. He's written, internet credits, productivity would skyrocket, as would old people's bank accounts.
And I think that's a good point.
It's a good pension, good way of avoiding increasing the pension.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'll pay that. What have we got now, guys?
We've got this, guys. Japanese Foreign Minister Hirofumi Nakasone has dropped a verbal bomb on Steven Spielberg, accusing his latest Indiana Jones film, Indiana Jones in the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, of trivialising the devastation caused by a nuclear explosion. In a speech against nuclear weapons, Mr. Nakasone explained, "There was a scene in a hit movie last year in which the famous hero facing a blast from a nuclear test hid in a refrigerator. A nuclear explosion destroys everything in an instant. I felt concerned that this kind of easygoing image might spread out around the world." So, guys, will Indiana Jones influence young minds to hide in refrigerators as a means of surviving nuclear attack?
I've got to say, that was my first concern when I saw that scene. I thought, what about the children?
I honestly, you know, I did. It was like I was Mrs. Lovejoy from The Simpsons, and I just thought, you know, someone think of the kids, and I'm outraged.
How was it passed off in the film? Like, was it lead line?
It was a lead line fridge.
It was a lead line fridge, and also it's Indiana Jones, so I think
that was not a proper Indiana Jones.
Suspension of disbelief. That was a great film. You enjoyed it.
Have we considered the possibility that it might actually be realistic, and that it may be an alternative for bunkers?
Have we been caught in a nuclear blast? In a fridge or out of a fridge, even.
So we need to actually test it. We need a volunteer. Guys, write in.
Write in if you'd like to volunteer to be in a nuclear blast.
Nuclear crash test dummy.
Can I just say, finally, I think that movie was the second worst movie.
Second
of all time.
Best movie. Second of all time.
Worst. Yeah. Well, hey, what was Tim? What was the worst movie? And Chris, what was the best movie?
Attack Force with Steven Seagal.
Son of the Mask.
There we go. The Israeli Health Ministry has renamed swine flu Mexico flu in order to avoid causing offence to the nation's many Jews who cannot eat pork. Israel's reportedly at high risk from swine flu, but because pigs are judged to be unclean and Jewish dietary law forbids the consumption of pork, the Israeli government has taken the step to officially rename the disease Mexico flu. Does anyone think that calling it Mexico flu might cause more offence to Mexicans than calling it swine flu does to religious Jews, guys?
I don't know. Shouldn't they call it Mexico flu? No,
they are,
Tim.
They are calling it
Mexican flu.
They're calling it Mexico flu. That's what Casey just said.
Flu. Okay, that's what Casey said both times. You read it out.
I did notice you sleeping in the corner, but that's what I did say.
Yes,
Look, I'm like Napoleon. Napoleon used to do that. He would go to sleep for just 5 minutes in the middle of a conversation.
Look, I think the point is, Tim, we need to actually get you stocked with food so that you're not falling asleep during the show.
Micro sleeping.
Yeah. Micro. That'll wink, wink.
In unrelated news, a police officer is under investigation after allegedly writing on his own Facebook profile that he was keen to, quote, bash some long-haired hippies at the G20 protests. Police Constable Rob Ward apparently put the note on the social networking site on April 1st, the first day of the London protests. It stated, Rob Ward can't wait to bash some long-haired hippies at the G20. 20 minutes later, another Facebook user posted a reply that said, that's bad, but good in da same way, lol. The message was later removed from Ward's Facebook page. A spokeswoman for Scotland Yard said, the matter has been recorded and will be investigated appropriately. Surely this here is ample evidence for Facebook adding a dislike button for statuses and other various posts, there, guys?
I think someone's going to be defriended. But of course, you can't tell if you've been defriended, really.
Well, like, you can if you've got 400 got that, friends and then next day you've got six.
Or that Hungry Jack's thing that notifies you, if you even heard this. Hungry Jack's had an application a while ago in which you would be challenged to unfriend 10 of your friends to get a free Whopper. This was in the United States, Burger King, it would have been. But then it sent a message to everyone that you unfriended saying that this person prefers a Whopper to you.
Prefers a tenth of a Whopper to you.
Yeah. Why haven't we discussed this? That's genius.
This is an old story.
You're holding out on us.
I am more and more terrified of face space, everything I hear about it.
Everything you hear about it.
A police officer is under investigation after allegedly riding on his own... I've just read that one. Charges against the man who transformed his car into an imitation of the Popemobile for World Youth Day has been dropped in what he calls a victory for freedom of speech. The man, Ian Bryce, aged 59, of Sydney, had been facing charges of using a vehicle that did not comply with safety standards on the basis that the dummy Pope, holding a big gold phone which he attached to the top of his family sedan, was judged as likely to cause distraction. Mr. Bryce also explained that the Popemobile was also a big hit at the Mardi Gras, saying he still gets plenty of exposure from time to time. Guys, is the use of the word exposure advisable referencing Mardi Gras?
I don't think so, Casey. I think it's very irresponsible, and I think it could be offensive to certain members of the Catholic community. Tim?
I think the very fact that this has been called a victory for free speech is a sufficient argument against free speech.
And freedom of expression.
Yeah, well, both of these things are social evils, and this is an example of why this is true.
An imitation Popemobile just made from a regular car. Can I just point out that won't look like the Popemobile
holding a big gold phone,
which looks like a golf cart.
Yeah. Charges against the man who transformed. I'm just joking this time. Police in the Victorian town of Warrnambool say they are dumbfounded by the dumping of a live shark on the doorstep of a local newspaper. The two foot long Port Jackson shark was found lying at the front door of the Standard under cover of darkness after midnight on Wednesday. Police released it into the harbour after carrying it in a bucket of water borrowed from a McDonald's restaurant. We arrived and poured some water on it just to see if it was still breathing, and it kicked around for a little while, Constable Gerald Dwyer told State Radio. Constable Dwyer's partner, Acting Sergeant Greg Cressel, told the Warrnambool Standard that it was one of the most bizarre incidents he had come across in his time as a police officer. We've had some strange things in the van before, but never a shark, he said. A fisheries official told the paper that the sharks were harmless, except for two venomous dorsal spines. Guys, how would you react to opening your door to find a small shark on your doorstep, and has McDonald's got really good advertising out of this story?
Well, I think if it were a card shark, I'd invite him in for a game of cards.
I would be really surprised. The dominant emotion I would feel would be surprise, because a shark is not the type of thing you expect to find on a doorstep.
Matteo, you're from Eastern Europe. Are there any organized crime, you know, crime organizations that have leaving a shark at your front door as
akin to a horse's head in your mouth?
Yeah. I saw that in a movie once.
Yeah, and a good movie it was indeed. I can attest that I am, in fact, from Eastern Europe. I don't know, maybe that happens in the other part of Eastern Europe, the bad part.
There aren't many sharks in Eastern Europe, are there? Because mostly it's, many of the countries are landlocked, I would have thought. So
my part of Eastern Europe isn't.
Well, I still wouldn't think sharks would be in particular high frequency.
It's probably a bit cold.
Wouldn't it be more likely, like, you know, like warheads and such?
Perhaps.
Former Soviet warheads, I
yeah,
would have
perhaps.
In what appears to be the first criminal prosecution stemming from a post on the popular microblogging site Twitter, an Oklahoma City man who tweeted on the site that he would turn an April 15 tax protest into a bloodbath was charged last week with making interstate threats. 52-year-old Daniel Knight Hayden was arrested by 52 FBI agents after being identified as the Twitter user Citizen Quasar. In a series of tweets starting on April 11, Hayden vowed to start a war against the government on the steps of the Capitol building, the site of Oklahoma City's version of the National Tea Party protest promoted by Fox News. "Start the killing now. I'm willing to be the first death," read a tweet at 8:01 p.m. that day. "After I'm killed on the Capitol steps like a real man, the rest of you will remember me," Hayden added 5 minutes later. "Then, send the cops around. I'll cut their heads off the heads and throw them on the state capitol steps." Additionally, Hayden's MySpace page contains a gallery of right-wing memes about the New World Order, comparing gun control to Nazi fascism and Barack Obama's use of television hypnosis, among others. Hayden's penultimate tweet at 12:49 a.m. on April 15 returned to the subject of his martyrdom. "Locked and loaded for the Oklahoma state capitol. Let's see what happens." Guys, I think we all know the real question here. How did a 52-year-old find out about Twitter?
I don't know. I don't know how to find out about Twitter. Where does one go?
Well, you find out about it from us. Whereas we find out about it from...
No, you guys just invent verbs and expect me to understand.
I think you go to cyberspace, don't you? Which, as I understand, yeah, it's sort of like a big pipe, right?
And no, that's exactly not what it is.
No, cyberspace is just air.
That's not allowed. You can't... Yeah, good on you, Casey.
A mutant superhero is no match for the swine flu that has killed in excess of 150 people in Mexico. 20th Century Fox says it will scrap plans to release X-Men Origins Wolverine in Mexico this weekend, saying instead the film, which stars Hugh Jackman, will be delayed by a couple of weeks. The rapid outbreak of the strain of flu has prompted the closure of dozens of cinemas in Mexico City, the country's capital, in a bid to limit large public gatherings that could facilitate the spread of the flu. In other movie news, the new Star Trek film flies into 50 countries, including Mexico, next weekend. It's currently unknown whether its release will be delayed. So, guys, what do you want to see more, the new Wolverine film or the new Star Trek film? Guys?
I have no desire to see films.
And can I just say that I think that this sort of trivialises what's a serious issue? I'm actually quite concerned about the swine flu thing.
You're terrified.
Well, I mean, because there might be some in Queensland, and the thing about it is that it spreads quickly, and it kills my aged people more frequently.
See, we have an interesting, like, thread here on the panel. I've got, like, a scientific curiosity. Chris is just terrified, and Matteo just couldn't care less.
No, the thing is, cyberspace is like carbon.
Cut him off.
Broadband is like a big pipe. They're not...
Very interesting, Matteo.
It's like the equivalent of carbon. We have to cut down our cyberspace.
Well, yeah, all I know about this is Lewin told me that there's certain flu vaccines earlier today. They've just discovered that certain flu vaccines will, I don't know about...
Antivirals will
help prevent the spread of the disease. So I'm happy now.
So I can continue not caring.
Yeah. All of the 12 men arrested in connection with a suspected UK bomb plot have been released without charge, although 11 of the men have been transferred to the custody of the Borders Agency and face possible deportation. The Crown Prosecution Service said there was insufficient evidence to press charges or hold them for any longer. The Muslim Council of Britain said that the government had behaved very dishonourably over the treatment of the men, 11 of whom were Pakistani nationals, and should admit it had made a mistake. The raids had to be brought forward following a blunder by the UK's most senior counter-terrorism officer, Bob Quick. He quit his post a day after the operation, after he accidentally revealed operational details to photographers from a document he was carrying. So, guys, does this mean that suspected terrorists do, in fact, watch the news, contrary to what we thought a couple of weeks ago?
Apparently so.
Yeah, well, apparently they did see that, you know, the documents weren't in the manila envelope, as they should have been. They were, in fact, facing the camera. They were, in fact, quite visible to anyone who took a closer look. So, kudos to them. They're clever people.
Clever terrorists.
Suspected terrorist. Charges were dropped.
Look, I think we have to ban him from Rapid Fire News. Yeah. He just doesn't know. He doesn't know the rules, and he doesn't abide by them. Disrespect. You're banned next week.
I have such creativity.
Your mic is not going to be on next week during Rapid Fire News.
You can't silence me.
Look, we can't silence you entirely because we'll be able to hear the echo of your voice in all of our mics, but you won't be out very well audible, and that's...
Let's do this.
Blur there with Charmless Man. Now, speaking of Charmless Men, Tim...
Yes, Barack Obama.
Yes, Barack Obama.
It's been 100 days.
Not quite. What? It's been 97 days, 22 hours, 19 minutes and 46 seconds since Barack Obama was inaugurated as President of the United States.
This is important. I would wish you wouldn't sigh, because think of all the things one can do in 2 days and two hours.
Well, judging by what he's done in 97, I imagine there won't be an awful lot more done.
We're getting to the end of the first 100 days of his presidency. Traditional time to kind of look back, see what he's done, see what he can do.
But apparently the American public is very...
Does it date back to the Depression?
It's FDR. It goes back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who effectively in 100 days slapped the United States economy out of the Depression and started it on the road to recovery.
Oh, but he didn't get a dog, Tim, did he? Portuguese water dog?
What's the dog's name?
This is not...
See, only today that I realised it's when we were speaking about it. The dog's name is Bo, apparently, which I only just realised is the initials.
Look, to be honest, guys, I thought he was named Bo after Obama, as in, like, Obama.
Obama, but that's not right. That's wrong.
I just think of Bo Peep.
I am so ashamed to be on this show. This is a serious political show, and we're talking about Barack freaking Obama's dog, okay?
But it's not, hold on, it's not just his dog. The dog belongs to the whole family. Michelle Obama, I don't know the name of the children.
It's the first puppy. Didn't we place a moratorium on you saying Barack freaking Obama?
Yes, but I thought I'd break the rule just the once. I've been wanting to say that for quite a while.
How's Obama done? What has he done well?
Well, what has he done, yeah.
Well, that's what I want to know.
Start with the good points.
If somebody would tell me.
Suspending Guantanamo Bay, I think that's at least announcing that it will, I think that's a positive step.
Well, he did that straight away.
Straight away. And that was, you know, that's, you can't deny it, Tim, or you can. You could deny it.
I'm just saying, my man John McCain would have done that as well. He was promising that.
But hold on, it's no good saying John McCain would have done that too. He didn't win the election. He didn't do it, Tim.
Okay. Good on him for shutting down the Guantanamo Bay detention centre.
He wasn't very close to winning the election.
We've also got the ban on embryonic stem cell research. Placed by George W. Bush's administration. He's lifted
the gag rule, so Barack Obama making it easier to kill babies.
According to others, that's a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Killing babies, great for America.
Increasing freedom of choice.
Freedom of choice and freedom of expression, Tim.
You guys don't want to go down this road. Why don't we talk about
Tim,
Iraq?
You're being contentious again.
Why don't we talk about Iraq? Because this has been I would see this as something that's reasonably positive. One of the very few things.
This is one of the times where we agree strongly on foreign policy, Tim. Yeah. I actually think the point of view he's taken has been very responsible. There were calls for him to pull everyone out immediately, and that's not the path he's taken.
He's done precisely what he said he would do at the beginning of the election, and I think that the situation in Iraq has gotten better, and this is because of the shift in military strategy that we saw in the last few years of the Bush administration. I would see that in large part as being a contributing factor. The situation has got better. He's withdrawing troops from there. We are in a rapidly descending mess in Afghanistan.
I agree in part. I don't know that I think you could demonstrate conclusively that the surge, which is what you're talking about,
is actually the cause of it,
because they've been trying the surge, or pretty much the same tactic in Afghanistan, and it hasn't worked to the same extent. And I know the scenario is different, but I'm just saying it's different.
We can agree that there's light at the end of the tunnel.
We can agree that there's light at the end of the tunnel, perhaps.
Yeah. As opposed to Afghanistan.
Although in Iraq, probably there's always a lot of light, because it's...
Thank you, Chris.
And let us remember that the beginning of Obama's first term in office has coincided with a situation, not entirely without precedent, but perhaps without precedent in a sort of globalised world where America sneezes and the rest of the world catches a cold. The financial climate as it stands. He's had to deal with this, as well as the fact that he's, a new presence. So he has to deal with the standard domestic issues and this one.
Well, how's he dealt with it as a very inexperienced president?
He's wrecked up the biggest deficit as a percentage of GDP in peacetime the United States.
He's thrown money at it, but then, Tim, what could he have done?
And the other thing is, the main problem, like part of the reason that the Great Depression occurred in the first place was that people refused to back up industry and banking systems, and therefore everything collapsed, and that caused more problems.
And there was protectionism.
What else should he do? The thing is, action was necessary at the time, and he was in a difficult position. It's hard to know whether it will work. But I think the fact that he actually acted decisively important.
I'm going to make quite a controversial statement here. What the United States needs is a massive socialization of the way its public policy works. The United States government needs to stop taxing. Its tax rates are 10% too low, and they need to be bumped up 10%. And in doing that, they need to be providing decent healthcare and education. Now, Barack Obama was the man that the United States elected to do that. They want the people, you know, that is something that needs to happen in this country. And in 100 days, what he's done is he's spent 100, you know, he's spent, what, about $2 trillion on bailing out industry. And I don't see, you know, and he's got a huge amount of political capital, the likes of which we haven't seen since Kennedy. And what I want to see in the next 100 days and the 100 days after that, which are going to be the important ones.
Next 103 days, Tim.
I want to see the beginning of a new socialization in the United States. I want him to see what him do, what FDR did, because it's what they need and it's the only way they're going to get out of the mess.
Tim, I agree completely.
Just well, yeah, say, we've seen, we just hear what Tim wants Obama to have done in the first 100 days. What else do we think Obama should have done, should have concentrated on his first 100 days? Or what should he be doing in the next 2 days, 2 hours, no, 1.5 hours, 2 days, 1.5 hours that he's got left until the end of his 100 days? What should he?
I think maybe we'll just let him relax. Right? It's not too harsh.
I don't know. I mean, this is not something that's on the agenda, but I actually think foreign aid needs to be addressed. The US government has increased foreign aid since to September 11th and the war in Iraq, and I don't think it's actually being conducted effectively. There's a lot of evidence that the way aid is tied is not effective. I think it should be addressed. I think they should look at ways of doing it more effectively if they can, because there's no point throwing money as they are if they're not actually able to guarantee.
As sympathetic as I am to positions on foreign aid, I think a country that's running a debt that is $11.15 trillion, and it's going to get bigger.
Tim, the trouble with that is they're giving foreign aid as it is. They're not cutting foreign aid. They're giving it. And so I'm just saying, if they're going to give foreign aid, they need to do it more effectively.
I think, and I understand, I appreciate that. And obviously what I'm saying is not a hard and fast rule, but I would like to see the primary attention of bureaucracy directed at more helping the United States rather than helping poor people in the rest of the world. Because the fact of the matter is that when the United States economy goes broke, then it's the poor people in the third world who suffer the most. And so I think, you know, if they want to help the economies of the other places in the world, I know you're grimacing, Christopher, we may have to leave it there.
I mean, maybe just a very final word. I mean, we'll just say, you know, just like, how would we rate his first almost 100 days? I mean, I suppose all we can say is that short of doing something as dramatic as what Tim has proposed, he's really dealt with things in the only way he could have.
We're running a bit short on time, so I think the best way of doing this might be a mark out of 10. I'm going to go 7.
Ooh, I'm a bit put on the spot. I'm going to go with 7.5.
A 4.
6.
0.5.
I might go down to 6.75.
I might go down to 7 and then back up to 7.5.
Tim?
2/3 pie.
Okay. All right, let's go to this.
In Battle Hospital, Reading, on May 15th, 1953, one of the greatest musical minds of the 20th century was born. But on April 28th, 2009, we return to this, the most recent semi-biweekly edition of Left, Right and Centre, unless you are podcasting, in which case it may or may not be the most current edition, owing, not surprisingly, to the passage of time, unless it still is the most current edition, in which case it is due to insufficient amounts of the passage of time having happened so far. To recap, you are listening to Left, Right and Centre on 101.5, and that brings me neatly to the point of this section. Golf. Many people in the modern world are becoming increasingly edgy and bad-tempered. Likewise, many are playing more golf, and these two things can hardly be unrelated. In fact, closer study shows that increase in golf is directly proportional to anger, as you can see from this graph. In fact, what is really surprising is that this conclusion wasn't reached earlier, as you only have to step onto a golf course yourself to feel its negative influence. No sooner are your feet on the turf than your palms go clammy, you hunch, and you start forcefully bringing things into contact with other things. With each swing, multiple white, dimpled missiles of anger depart from your presence with haste. Their destination, the windscreens of the innocent. The transformation is instant and irreversible. Actually, that's a slight exaggeration to the detriment of my argument, because the onset of golf is gradual, and this more than anything else is its most dangerous feature. This is how it works. One day you decide you would like to play golf. By the time you arrive at the club, you have had ample journey time to reflect on past defeats, and yet you will always, always ignore them, somehow convincing yourself that this time will be better. That this time, you will win. This is invariably not the case, but even so, the first few holes always go well. You will be perhaps one over par at worst, and then on the fourth green, everything goes to pieces. I once saw a group of three people a few holes ahead of me on my local course, whose game had literally degenerated into throwing their clubs at some pigeons. Now, I'm not one to defend the behaviour of pigeons. In fact, as anyone else who has had to spend 8 hours hosing their excrement off of chairs can attest, they have a great deal to answer for. But I couldn't help feeling sorry for them. The pigeons, that is, not the youths. Worryingly, the problem has started to manifest itself in far more bizarre ways. Yesterday, or again, if you're podcasting, more than likely not yesterday, a man in the street stopped myself and a friend for a couple of dollars, because he was short and needed to burn a CD. I struggled to think how urgent the operation of burning this CD was for him to have to ask someone else for the money. Burning a CD was obviously not some sort of euphemism, because he pointed at the music store behind him as he said it. And what really irritates me is this. My friend gave him $2, and I said, quite truthfully, "I'm sorry, I haven't any change." He asked my friend for more money. More to the point, when we subsequently established that neither of us had any change anymore, he just walked off, almost certainly to accost someone else. He actually had the nerve to come up to us and ask for money for possibly the worst cause I have ever heard of. He actually got $2, more than a reasonable amount from my friend, and when we were out of change, and hence worthless to him, he simply refused to acknowledge our continued existence anymore, giving him the unique distinction of being the most rude person ever to ask for money from me. Now you may say, hang on a minute, what does that have to do with golf? And you would certainly be right to harbour such scepticism. Coming up next, cricket sweaters and where to find them.
It's time for us to skedaddle.
Three halves pie.
Yep.
I meant to say three halves
you
pie.
You said two-thirds pie.
Which is about to. Pie.
Tim, I've remarked before that mathematics on the radio...
I had the fraction in my head and it flipped around as I was speaking.
Can I just say, my mother was quite upset with me during the week, but she thinks that my diction and clarity need a good amount of work on radio. Actually, well, Tim, she says that you're very lovely to listen to on radio.
I know.
You have a very pleasant voice.
It well, makes she may a good not contrast for your face, I think, Tim.
Chris, that's not nice. We have to be civil with one another. And so, Mum, sorry I haven't removed the wine from my room, and I love you very much.
And you'll work on saying remuneration.
That's a difficult word to say.
Well, that's why you have to practice. Practice, practice, practice.
But it's not often often.
Yeah, you know what, perhaps
practice
not...
makes perfect.
Okay, you know, perhaps the listeners don't need to hear this.
Mm. All I was going to say was practice material, or you might as well give the clarinet to someone who uses it. It's time for us to go because it's 1 a.m. and we're tired.
And, you know, we've pretty much done our dash, I think. We should extraduce ourselves, outroduce ourselves.
I'm going to outroduce Tim. That's Tim.
Has been outroduced.
I'm Timothy. That's Christopher over there.
Timothy is very exasperated in the studio. I'm Mateo Cha-Cha from me.
And I am Chris over here. That's true. Good night.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. Don't forget Student Radio every Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m., including Left, Right and Centre at midnight every Tuesday. Cha-Cha.